This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:19 p.m. on Wednesday, March 4th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Freer, Representative Nelson, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have two bills on the agenda today. First is HB 362 about respiratory care licensing, and second will be HB 352, which is about licensing compacts. So first up is HB 362, respiratory care license. This is a committee bill which I will be presenting alongside my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson. And for that, I'm going to pass the gavel to co-chair Phil Fields for the bill presentation.
Thank you, Representative Hall. And Joan Wilkerson, and the record will reflect that at 3:20, Representative Sadler joined the committee. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Carolyn Hall. I represent House District 16, which is West Anchorage, specifically the neighborhoods of Sand Lake, Spinard, and Turnagain. This bill is about respiratory therapist licensure. Respiratory therapists are clinicians who manage ventilators, assist with life-saving procedures, and provide essential care to patients with respiratory failure. In Alaska, respiratory therapists are not required to have a license. Alaska is the only state in the nation that does not license respiratory care practitioners. HB 362 would create a licensing process to increase patient safety and bring Alaska up to national standards. Respiratory care practitioners manage some of the most technically complex and life-critical tasks in patient care, especially in intensive care units, emergency departments, and during public health emergencies, such as the COVID-19 pandemic. Without licensing, there is no formal way to ensure these providers meet minimum qualifications or protect the public from negligence or misconduct. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, if it pleases you, I can turn this over to Joan Wilkerson for the sectional.
That sounds great, and I'll just recognize Representative Glum joined at 3:21. Go ahead, Ms. Wilkerson.
For the record, Joan Wilkerson, through the chair. Section one of the sectional analysis for HB 362 respiratory care licensure adds respiratory care practitioners to the professions regulated by the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Section 2 adds respiratory care practitioners to the list of healthcare providers required to use as professional identification appropriate letters or a title after their name that indicates their specific field of practice. Section 3 adds respiratory care practitioners to the definition of healthcare provider under the telehealth statute at AS 0802-130. Section 4 creates a new chapter, AS 08.90, respiratory care practitioners. AS 08.90/010 through 090 describes license requirements, prohibits the practice of respiratory care without a license, describes the scope of practice, and permits current respiratory care practitioners under the direction of a physician to become licensed, and requires continuing respiratory care education, and makes a violation of these terms a misdemeanor. Section 5 adds respiratory care practitioners to the definition of healthcare provider for purposes of medical malpractice law. Section 6 adds respiratory care practitioners to the definition of healthcare provider under AS 0965-300-CI definitions for immunity for providing healthcare services. Section 7 adds respiratory care practitioners to the definition of healthcare provider under AS 1430-141-E, which is the definitions of pupil self-administration of medications for asthma or anaphylaxis in schools. And Section 8 extends protections to respiratory care practitioners under AS 2136090D, which prohibits unfair discrimination under group health insurance policies against respiratory care practitioners when providing covered services within the scope of license. Section 9 allows individuals already practicing respiratory care before the effective date to continue practicing for up to 1 year without a license while obtaining licensure, and Section 10 provides an effective date of January 1st, 2027.
Great. Okay. I think, do members have questions? Why don't we turn to invited testimony? First up is Angela Oyer, Director of Respiratory Care at the Sleep Lab and Cardiac Pulmonary Rehabilitation Center at Central Peninsula. Looks like Ms. Euler is here in person.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Alaska House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Angela Euler. I'm a registered respiratory therapist and president of the Alaska Society for Respiratory Care. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 362, legislation establishing licensure for respiratory care practitioners in our state. Respiratory therapists play a critical role in caring for Alaskans across the lifespan, from premature infants in the NICU to emergency department patients to individuals with chronic lung disease and critically ill patients requiring mechanical ventilation. We often are at the patient's bedside during their most vulnerable moments. Currently, Alaska is the only state that does not require licensure for respiratory therapists. House Bill 362 is an important step towards ensuring consistent standards in education, competency, accountability, and professional oversight. Licensure protects Alaskans by verifying that those that are providing complex cardiopulmonary care already have met clear standards of practice. This bill was carefully drafted using scope of practice language from other states and aligned with national best practices. It does not expand the role of respiratory therapists beyond what we are already trained and nationally credentialed to do. Rather, it formalizes and provides a regulatory framework that supports safe, high-quality care. Respiratory therapists practice under physician direction and medical orders. We are integral members of the healthcare team, collaborating closely with physicians, nurses, and other professionals to deliver evidence-based care. Licensure does not change this collaborative model. It strengthens it by ensuring that all practitioners meet uniform standards. I would like to highlight an important part of this legislation, the grandfather clause for currently practicing certified respiratory therapists in the state of Alaska. Our aim is not to restrict or displace anyone who is currently practicing in good standing in our state. It is very important to us that those serving Alaskan communities today can continue in their roles. House Bill 362 offers a pathway for current CRTs to attain licensure without disrupting their employment, acknowledging their expertise and years of service. At this time, we believe it's important for Alaska to align with the rest of the nation, where the profession is steadily moving towards a registered respiratory therapist standard as a minimum credential for entry-level practice. Establishing licensure allows us to both honor our current workforce and thoughtfully transition towards nationally recognized standards that reflect the increasing complexity of respiratory care. Patient safety is our primary concern. Licensure provides transparency, accountability, and a mechanism that addresses concerns should they arise. It assures Alaskans that the person managing their ventilator, assisting with airway emergencies, or delivering life-sustaining therapies have met rigorous professional standards. House Bill 362 focuses on protecting Alaskan patients. It aims to align Alaska with national standards and ensure our state continues to provide safe, high-quality respiratory care. On behalf of respiratory therapists across Alaska, I respectfully ask your support and swift passage of House Bill 362. Thank you all for your time and consideration, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Euler. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. I was going to make sure Euler first. Ms. Euler, through the chair, there are a lot of references to respiratory care practitioner, RCP. I've always referred to friends in the practice under RT, respiratory therapists. Is that a deliberate change in nomenclature? Is that something I've been saying wrong all along? And
not necessarily. Yeah. It's a very interchangeable term, I would say. Respiratory care practitioners versus respiratory therapists. It's used both.
Of course.
Could you help me understand, kind of for the baseline information of the committee, what are the education requirements and current national certification standards for respiratory therapists or RCPs?
Current national standards for that are to be, you have to go through a college that is CORC accredited, and then also you have to pass an exam with the National Board for Respiratory Care, either as a certified respiratory therapist or a registered respiratory therapist. The registered respiratory therapist is a higher level, and there is a push nationwide to make the registered respiratory therapist the standard and phase out the certified portion.
I have other questions, but don't want to be piggy, so.
I don't see anyone else in line. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Ms. Weiler, are the folks you represent in your society okay with the licensing fees and the regulatory costs of setting up this licensing board?
Yes. Yes, they are.
Oh, that's good. I got more.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, please comment on the number of respiratory therapists in Alaska, if it is sufficient to meet the need, and what the effect of licensure through this bill would be on that supply.
So there are currently around 200.
You have to say through the chair. Here.
I'm so sorry. Through the chair. There are currently.
I don't care and didn't notice. Right. It is the proper protocol.
Okay.
So thank you for following
apologies.
It, but I did not notice.
Yes, there are currently around 200 respiratory therapists in the state.
Is that enough?
I would say no. I think that we'll need a steady incline in respiratory therapists throughout the years with the aging population.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler, if you have another
chair. And the effect, I guess the question last one was, the effect of licensure, would that bring us more? Would it decrease? What would that do for the supply and service?
I don't believe that it would decrease the number of therapists that would come here. I think it would allow us to have a higher standard. Not that anybody currently practicing here is not at a high standard, but I believe it would bring us highly qualified individuals to our state. I don't feel that it would decrease the number of respiratory therapists coming here.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Chair.
Yep. Representative Carrick and then Representative Clem.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here. I think maybe you just answered my question, but there's a grandfathering clause in this legislation. Are there any anticipated respiratory therapists currently working in Alaska who would likely not meet the standards of this legislation?
I don't believe there's currently anybody in the state that's currently working that would not meet that with the grandfather clause present. They definitely would need to provide the certification from the National Board for Respiratory Care to prove that they are a certified respiratory therapist, but I don't believe there's currently anybody in the state that's practicing that wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Clem.
Yeah, through the chair, so I guess hopefully you're pretty familiar with the bill, but I just wanted to ask about the section about the scope of practice of respiratory care. Is this scope pretty much the same in other states? Is this pretty standard?
Yes.
Is the scope bigger or smaller than other states?
Yes, I would say it's very similar to other states and was drafted based off of several other states and national standards.
Okay, so you follow up? So you don't have there is anything specific that was taken away or added. It's pretty standard language.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Through the chair, Ms. Weiler, would licensure allow any changes in the status of RTs? What insurance programs they might be able to bill? Would it raise the pay or working conditions of the licensed people?
Not to my knowledge, but I would be happy to get back to you, try to research that and get back to you.
And Representative Zeller, we do have one more invited testifier, so maybe that's she right. can help answer that question.
And I will just, if I may just say, the fact that you didn't know that and that was not the primary driver was impressive. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Do members have more questions for Ms. Weiler? Okay. Thank you for being here, Ms. Weiler, and answering lots of questions. Next up is, I think, Miriam O'Day, Senior VP, Government Affairs, American Association for Respiratory Care. Ms. O'Day, please proceed.
Yes, thank you for holding this hearing today, and thank you for allowing me to testify remotely. I represent the American Association of Respiratory Care. This is the national organization that represents about 130,000 respiratory therapists nationwide. We are pleased to offer strong support for legislation to establish licensure for respiratory therapists in the state of Alaska, and are therefore very supportive of HB 362. This legislation, we believe, is first and foremost about protecting the public. You heard what the scope of practice is for respiratory therapists and some of the things that they do. I'll tell you that they're the highly trained allied health professionals who manage life-sustaining therapies. They care for premature infants who are struggling to breathe, trauma patients on ventilators, individuals experiencing severe asthma attacks, patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and Alaskans recovering from pneumonia, sepsis, and respiratory failure. When someone needs to be intubated, nurses are not interested. A respiratory therapist is always called. In many communities, particularly rural and remote areas, respiratory therapists are essential members of the frontline healthcare team. Yet without licensure, there's no uniform statutory standard to ensure minimum education requirements, national credentialing verification, continuing competency standards, disciplinary oversight for unsafe practices. Licensure provides a clear, enforceable framework that protects the public by ensuring only qualified individuals may deliver complex respiratory care services. Respiratory therapists routinely manage ventilators, perform airway management, administer high-risk medications such as bronchodilators and inhaled nitrous oxide. They do arterial blood gas sampling, and they provide non-invasive ventilation in emergency situations, as well as treating neonatal and pediatric respiratory patients. Currently, all states, with the exception of Alaska, license respiratory therapists and rely on nationally recognized credentials from one credentialing body, the National Board for Respiratory Care. And as Ms. Euler stated, in January of 2027, the CRT will be phased out as a credential and only RRTs will be licensed. These requirements ensure that there's a minimum level of competency for respiratory therapists, and licensure in Alaska would align the state with established national best practices and protect patients through a formal oversight system, provide clarity to employers and healthcare facilities, and your geography presents some unique challenges. Patients often receive care in remote and resource-limited settings where respiratory therapists function with some autonomy, although their billing is always done incident to, and as Ms. Euler pointed out, they are in a collaborative healthcare model. We are concerned that being the only state without licensure makes Alaska a target for respiratory therapists who are unable to receive licensure in other states. This is why the AARC strongly supports licensure in Alaska. Licensure strengthens public trust and ensures that vulnerable populations, including rural residents, Alaska Native communities, seniors, and children, receive care from professionals who meet rigorous standards. Families trust respiratory therapists during their most frightening moments. Licensure is not about professional recognition alone. It's about ensuring that every patient in Alaska can trust that the person who's managing their breathing has met clear, enforceable standards of competence. AARC respectfully urges you to pass this legislation to establish respiratory care licensure in Alaska, and we thank you for your commitment to protecting the health and safety of all Alaskans.
Okay, do members have questions for Ms. O'Day? Go ahead, Rep. Klum.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. O'Day, so right now in Alaska, since an employer can't just check to see if you're licensed, how does that happen? Do they have their own standards that they have to meet? Because it sounds like they're practicing here. Do you know what they look for? Or so right now, there's no consistency. It kind of depends on what the employer is requiring to hire
one. It's a good question. I think that they check that they have a credential, but again, there's no oversight body.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, and through the chair, Ms. O'Day. Yeah, again, ask you the same question I asked Ms. Euler, just to give us a better perspective on the training requirements. What's the duration of programs? Where are the centers of excellence for RTs? Just information about how the education, qualification, and testing.
So the education program, we only support education programs that are certified by COARC, and those can be a two-year program. Some respiratory therapists do have a baccalaureate degree. And is the question about the difference between the CRT and the RRT? CRT and RRT used to be the same test. It just that if you received the RRT, you had a higher cut. But generally, those who have an RRT have done some clinical hours during their training.
Okay. And to clarify, thank you. Ms. Euler told me, I believe, or I've heard that a baccalaureate degree, a four-year degree, is required from an accredited by a certain accrediting organization, and then the specific training for respiratory therapy. Is that correct? Is it a four-year plus two-year kind of thing, or is it just a two-year?
No, it's a two-year. You can get a two-year degree, a community college degree.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Burr, or Freer.
Thank you, through the chair, and I just want to thank the co-chair for bringing this piece of legislation. I think I have a unique perspective. I work as a human resources professional in a hospital and work alongside RTs. And we, you know, as the employer, we set the requirements of our job descriptions, and we require a CRT or a CRRT already, and we have education requirements that are within our job descriptions. But I just want to talk about, you know, some of my experiences. There have been instances where, because there isn't a licensure that we can verify, or maybe they previously possessed a license, but they lost their license, where we've brought people on board and they've passed our background checks, but something has fallen through the cracks, or it hasn't come to light yet, we have seen folks that are coming from out of state that are targeting Alaska just because of that. And I do just want to say, on a personal note, with family, my grandmother, she fought a long, hard battle with lung cancer, and it was towards end of life, the end of life care that we received from the RT was just amazing for our family. So I appreciate this legislation, and I look forward to supporting it. I want to note that it doesn't create an advisory board. The licensing, I believe, would go through CBPL as well as any disciplinary that goes through. If I'm understanding that correctly, Representative Hall and Ms. Euler, and so. I just wanted to make that note. I have professional experience in this specific area. And
Thank you, Representative Freer. Sylvan Robb is here if members do have questions from CBPL. Any further questions for any of our testifiers? Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. My colleague across the representative from the UAF district, does the University of Alaska Anchorage or Fairbanks provide the training necessary to become a registered respiratory therapist in Alaska?
Sounds like Ms. Euler has an answer to that. Come on, Ms. Euler.
Very good. Okay, very good.
Pretty certain they do not.
There is no program in
this. And if you don't mind just listing your name for the record, I know it sounds duplicative.
No, that's okay. Angela Euler. Thank you. Currently, there is no program in the state of Alaska for respiratory care.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill.
Okay. Do members have further questions? I mean, we can pass this bill right now, too, if members prefer, or we can set an amendment deadline and do it Monday. Does anyone have a preference? Representative Sadler.
I'd rather take a little time to read through.
No problem. Let's set an amendment deadline Monday, March 9th, 10 a.m. Thank you to our testifiers for showing up, and maybe there's one more question from Representative Sadler.
And if the testifiers with written testimony or prepared comments could submit those to the committee just for our reference, please. It's good to get those.
Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease and switch seats.
Yeah, because it's great hearing this stuff read out loud. But.
All right, we are back on record, time being 3:44 p.m. The second bill we will hear today is HB 352, Healthcare Licensing Compact, sponsored by Co-Chair Fields. We have Co-Chair Fields and his aide, Courtney Owens, here at the table. Would you please introduce yourselves for the record and begin your testimony?
Okay. For the record, Courtney Owens, Dr. Representative Fields.
Zach Fields, House District 17. I will quickly summarize this bill. I think as committee members are well aware, Alaska has received $272 million in round one of the Rural Health Transformation Program. I think the commissioner and her staff did a great job applying for that money. One of the things they said in the application, we weren't in legislative session, is that the legislature would diligently pursue a number of compacts. So when I was meeting with the commissioner prior to session, we were talking about some of these compacts. Some of them had not been introduced or heard before. So I simply asked Ledge Legal to introduce, to draft me up a bill with those compacts that we had not heard so we could run them by stakeholders and get their input. That is the bill you see before you today, House Bill 352. It has four interstate medical licensure compacts. The Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, the PA Licensure Compact, the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, and the EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. And I introduced this bill really without prejudice one way or another about whether these would be positive for the state of Alaska, but I thought it was valuable to hear from stakeholders. That is the purpose, and I guess my take on it is if stakeholders are broadly supportive, I don't see why we wouldn't pass this legislation. And with that, I'm happy to turn to Courtney Owen for a sectional analysis, if you would like that. She has been doing outreach to all these groups, and you can see some of the written testimony, and we have some of them online for verbal testimony today as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. And I also want to let the community know that we have several people available to help answer questions throughout the process, including Sylvan Robb, with the Division Director for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. We also have Lori Winghire in the room. She's the Legislative Healthcare Liaison for the House Majority. We also have Carl Sims, Program Director of the National Center for Interstate Compacts with CSG, and Donnie Woodyard, Executive Director at the Interstate Commission for EMS Personnel Practice. And I believe for the sectional, we're going to do things a little bit differently than we would for traditional bills, just because there's a lot of information in there. So instead of reading through the sectional all at once, what we're going to do is we're going to read a sectional for one compact, then we're going to go to the invited testifier, just to try to keep things as cohesive and understandable as possible for the committee. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Owens.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record again, my name is Courtney Owen. I am staff director at Fields, and I'll go through the first section. Sections 1 through 4 establish the Interstate Medical Medical Licensure Compact, IMLC. The IMLC adds the state medical board's duty to implement the compact and create a streamlined, expedited license pathway for physicians to practice across member states. A physician designates one member state as their state of principal license, typically their state of residence or primary practice, and that board verifies credentials and issues a letter of qualification. The physician may then obtain full, unrestricted licenses in additional member states without completing each state's full individual application process. To be eligible, a physician must hold a full, unrestricted license, have no criminal convictions or active disciplinary proceedings, and meet national education and certification standards. Fingerprint-based background checks are required as part of the application. Each state retains a complete authority to license, regulate, and discipline physicians practicing within its borders. Disciplinary action in any member state can trigger action in all others, and revocation of a physician's principal license automatically affects their license in all other member states. The compact is administered by an interstate commission with representatives from each member state. And I'll stop there, and I will hand it off to our invited testifier, Pam Benchin. She is the executive director of the Alaska State Medical Association.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall, and members of the committee. My name is Pam Benchin. I'm the executive director of the Alaska State Medical Association, which represents physicians and physician assistants throughout the state. The medical association has discussed the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact many times over the years. Initially, the association was concerned about encouraging physicians enabling physicians to more easily travel to Alaska, perform surgery on a Friday, go home on a Sunday, and leave patients without ongoing support. But things have changed. At the time, we wanted to encourage physicians who live and work in their Alaskan community and support local schools and local businesses. We thought their investment in the community was very important. But things do change, and there are now companies who employ traveling physicians, and those companies are well funded to pay licensure fees in as many states as possible. And so at this point, we think it's no longer a matter of if the compact will come, but when it will come. And since it's included in the Rural Health Transformation Program, now seems to be an excellent time to move forward on this. Physicians, as Cassidy said, the physicians who are licensed through the compact still pay Alaska licensing fees and license renewal fees. They must meet all of Alaska's requirements. The compact requirements are as strict, if not a tad bit stricter, than Alaska requirements. And so there are going to be physicians who cannot meet those standards. They can still apply for an Alaska license under the current guidelines and requirements. Being part of the compact would reduce the workload of the Division of Licensing while maintaining or increasing the fee structure for investigation and disciplinary cases handled by the board. Compacts are a national trend. Currently, there are 42 states and 2 territories that are members of the compact, so Alaska is one of very few that are not already in the compact. And again, we see this as a question of, not a question of if, but when we will move toward joining the compact. The compact only expedites the licensing process. It does not change the Alaska Medical Practice Act or the powers of the state medical board. About 80% of the physicians in the country, it's estimated, would be eligible for licensure through the compact. The remaining 20%, approximately, could still apply through traditional standards if they wanted to come to the state. There is no cost to the state to belong to the compact. The applicants pay the licensing fees and pay a processing fee to the compact. So the Alaska State Medical Association now supports movement toward joining the compact, and we encourage you to support House Bill 352. And I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Benchin. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've got some scoping questions. I can't even tell quite yet, although I have my suspicions. That does the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact now exist, or is it created by this bill?
It has existed since, I believe, 2015 or 2017. It's been around for a number of years and has grown, has become more common, especially with COVID and telehealth. It is obviously very common with 42 states and 2 more territories belonging. So it's been around for a while. It would not, this bill would allow Alaska to join the compact and be represented on the compact commission. It does not create the compact. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. And follow up.
Follow-ups.
Having read a number of different bills to either have the state join or, in some cases, establish a compact, I was intrigued by the declaring a, what was it, a primary? I'm having a hard time getting through. A primary state of licensure and then appealing for that. Help me understand, this is different than other compacts in some important ways. What are the differences?
To Representative Sadler, the applicant or the physician or physician assistant in this case would establish their principal state of licensure. That's usually the state, it's the state where they live or have their primary practice. And the compact has one state that does the initial licensure and verification of all of their training and education and you know, all of the requirements for licensure. And once that state has verified that the physician meets all those requirements, then the other states in the compact take that initial state's investigation into their background and adopt or accept that as adequate for each additional state.
Follow up.
I'm the analogy that comes to mind for me is that the state of Delaware, an awful lot of companies are headquartered in Delaware, an awful lot of ships at sea are registered in Liberia. I don't know if this would mean that, is it the case that physicians often, many of them designate one particular state as their state of principal licensure that may perhaps have more permissive standards for licensure? Does that happen in this business?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in joining the compact, the joining state, in this case Alaska, would agree to the minimum standards of the compact. And so all states in the compact have already agreed to minimum standards. So it wouldn't be, I mean, there, some states have higher standards, but no states in the compact have lower standards than the compact, than those that are agreed on by the states in the compact.
Okay. So I guess I'll
probably,
yes. So is there any, if there are some states that are harder, is it the case that there is a disproportionate designation of one particular or a couple of particular states as the state of principal licensure for those physicians that participate in the compact?
No, because the state, through the chair, the physician has to have, and the physician can only have a primary practice in one state. They have to establish either where they live or where, sometimes if they live on a state line, they might live in Kansas and work in Illinois or whatever is next door. And so it's where their principal, their main license, where they earn their living. And they may, we have radiologists, for example, that live in a state and read radiographs from a dozen states, but they have a state where they live and where their primary license is located. Often that's the state where they did their residency training, and that's why we like to encourage, our family medicine residency program in Alaska was established because we know historically physicians tend to remain in the state where they did their residency training. And so our family medicine residency has about 75 to 80% of those residents who finish their residency training in Alaska remain in Alaska. Most physicians, the majority of physicians, remain where they've done their residency training, and that's their principal license of, or state of licensure. There are no longer, to the best of my knowledge, there are no longer any states that have lenient licensing requirements.
Okay, there you go. I'll defer if anyone else have more questions.
We do have questions from other committee members. So thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to Ms. Venchin. You had said that there may possibly be areas in the compacts that supersede current Alaska licensure requirements. Do you know,
yes.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Thank you, Representative Chair, through the chair. The only one that I am aware of is that many states, and I believe the compact states, require fingerprinting for physicians. Alaska, as a license requirement, does not require physicians get fingerprinting. Hospitals and some corporations require that physicians do fingerprinting and background checks, but that's not a part of Alaska licensure.
And
so that's the only one that I'm aware of that would be more stringent than the compact.
Okay, and
most physicians in Alaska have already done that because they want to bill Medicaid or they want to have hospital privileges, but it's not currently a licensing requirement.
I see. Okay. I think she answered that.
Okay. Before returning to Representative Sadler, do other committee members have any questions? Have at it, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
And forgive me for kind of probing just to get the scope of things down. So this if the state were to join this licensure compact, then doctors from Oklahoma or California or Delaware could come into Alaska and practice on a short-term basis, or would they have to establish residency and meet any other standards, or simply would have to be a member of the compact to practice in Alaska, either in person or by teleconference, please?
Thank you. Representative Sadler, through the chair, they would not have to reside in Alaska. They could come up to Alaska and do locum tenens or do telehealth or do radiographs, radiology. They could come up on a temporary basis, which they're already doing through the locum tenens permit procedure. But anyone providing healthcare services to an Alaskan, with very few exceptions, are already required to be licensed in Alaska.
Okay.
Thanks. If anything, this would increase access to care by Alaskans.
Thank you.
Great. Not seeing further questions from the committee. Thank you very much for your invited testimony, Ms. Fenchin. Ms. Owen?
Thank you.
Thank you for the record again, Courtney Owen, staff to Upfields. Sections 1 through 4 also establish the PA licensure compact. This compact creates a mutual recognition framework for physician assistants rather than a separate expedited license. A PA holding a qualifying home state license may apply for a compact privilege to practice in any other participating state. Eligibility requirements, accredited PA education recognized by the Accreditation Review Commission on Education for the Physician Assistant, current national certification from the National Commission on Certification of Physician Assistants, and a clean disciplinary and criminal record. Each state retains authority over its own PA licenses and may discipline or revoke compact privileges for PAs practicing within its borders. A centralized data system tracks licensure status and adverse actions across all participating states, and if a PA's home state license is restricted or revoked, compact privileges in all other states are automatically suspended. And online we have Megan Hall, the former president of the Alaska Academy of Physicians Assistants, for our invited testimony.
Ms. Hall, if you're available, please unmute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, ma'am.
Okay. Hello. Hi. Thank you, co-chairs Fields and Halls and members of the House Labor and Committee, Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Megan Hall. I am a PA practicing in Anchorage and also the past president of the Alaska Academy of Physician Associates. I appreciate the chance to speak in support of HB 352, which would bring Alaska into the PA Licensure Compact. The PA Licensure Compact creates a streamlined, efficient process that allows qualified PAs licensed in one compact state to practice in another through what is called a compact privilege. It reduces the delays and administrative burdens that currently slow down the ability of PAs to begin practicing, especially when relocating. The compact does this while preserving each state's authority. PAs practicing in Alaska must still follow Alaska's scope of practice laws and regulations, and the compact does not change or expand those rules. For patients, the compact helps reduce delays they face when trying to receive care. In a state as geographically isolated as Alaska, any added delay caused by licensing barriers only makes access challenges worse. Improving licensure portability helps ensure that qualified PAs can enter the workforce more quickly, whether in person or through telemedicine, strengthening continuity of care for patients across Alaska. From a public safety standpoint, the compact also enhances protections by creating a shared licensure data system that allows compact states to exchange disciplinary and investigative information efficiently. This ensures that any PA practicing in Alaska under a compact privilege has met uniform national standards and remains accountable to the expectations of every state where they practice. The compact also benefits Alaska's PA workforce. It reduces the time and cost required to maintain multiple licenses
and increases employment flexibility, which is especially important for PAs whose families move frequently, including military spouses, an important population in our state. The compact has already reached the number of states required to go into effect and is expected to be operational in early 2027, meaning Alaska has the opportunity now to join early and ensure smooth implementation when the system launches. HB 352 represents a practical, low-cost way to improve healthcare access without sacrificing regulatory oversight or patient safety. It strengthens our ability to recruit and retain qualified clinicians, supports our military families, and modernizes our licensing framework, and ultimately helps ensure that Alaskans, no matter where they live, can receive timely, high-quality care. For these reasons, the AKAPA respectfully urges the committee to support HB 352 and adopt the PA Licensure Compact. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Hall, if you by chance were reading your testimony, would you please send it to the committee so we can read it?
Yes.
Very good. Look forward to that, please.
Thank you, Ms. Hall.
Okay.
Representative Klum.
Yeah, through the chair, Ms. Hall, does this compact cost the state anything? The compact that we heard prior, it sounded like the compact was covered by fees that physicians pay. Is that the same with this compact as well?
Yes, through the chair. That is the understanding, is that the fees paid for the permit to practice in the compact state would cover the cost of the compact.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Klum. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing none. Oh, wait. Oh, Representative Carrick. That's okay. Representative Carrick.
Thank you for testifying. And through the chair, I have just same question as I asked Ms. Venchin. Are there areas where the PA compact currently supersedes Alaska's requirements? And if you know of any place where that is, if you could just identify those areas.
I do believe, similar to the through the chair, Representative Carrick, that we have a similar requirement of the fingerprinting and background check, which is not part of the current state licensure requirements. So I believe once a PA was licensed, an example in Alaska, they would then, if they wanted to apply to the compact, would need to get that additional background check and fingerprinting in order to be eligible for the compact privileges.
Follow up? To the co-chair. I'm not quite sure who this question is to, but I guess it sounds like most of our physician assistants and medical providers are already, for their job applications, doing fingerprinting and background checks, and so there's probably not an added cost. But do we have any department representatives who could speak to whether there's an added cost?
Director Rob, would you please come forward and answer Representative Carrick's question? Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, the current fee for a fingerprint-based background check is $75, so that would be an additional cost for licensees, and that covers the fees that the Department of Public Safety incurs.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. And Ms. Robb, is there any additional cost anticipated to administer potentially additional fingerprint and background checks?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, the existing fingerprint fee would cover any additional costs that were incurred from that related to processing.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Robb, my general question is, is this an omnibus licensure bill? And I understand the desire to comply with the rural health transformation requirements, but are there other pieces of legislation that would let the state adopt or participate in these compacts other than this one bill, to your knowledge?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the only other compact that is currently introduced is the psychology compact, which was introduced by the representative sitting to your left.
So,
follow up.
So if we were to comply with the Rural Transformation Fund requirements, this would be a good vehicle. This would be a vehicle to do that. There are no alternatives at this point.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, this does, as the sponsor mentioned in his overview, there are five compacts that are mentioned in the grant application. This includes four of those five, so does get us 80% of the way there.
What's the other one?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, is the nurse licensure compact.
Is there a reason it couldn't be included in this, or? I just don't want to ask Ms. Rothers.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the bill has been introduced for a number of years, but as for the structure of the bill before the committee right now, that's really a question for Representative Fields.
And actually, but one more question for you. Is it true that if we don't comply with all of the requirements that our score gets dinged on the RTF money and we don't get more money next year if we don't do all the compacts required?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the Department of Health is are the ones who applied for the grant and have been in communication with Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services about the requirements, and so they could speak better to
the appropriate time. I don't want to interfere your thing.
It's a complicated funding model they've set up.
Okay, I believe we have a question from Representative Cologne.
Yeah, so through the chair, so this is a lot of compacts, and I just like your kind of your perspective on how this is going to change your job and the board's job. This is a lot that you guys will be taking on. Do you feel like this is going to be a big uphill climb? Is it not too hard to switch to these compacts? Like, how does it affect you and the board?
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, thank you for that question. We are supportive of seeing the state join these compacts. As one of the testifiers mentioned, interstate professional licensing compacts are kind of the wave of the future. We see more of them being created each year. It does allow for greater professionals as they're moving around. It makes it easier for us to attract professionals. I know that the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, through their studies, have found that 25% of healthcare professionals who come to Alaska on an interim or locum basis end up coming to Alaska. Alaska sells itself. and so if we can make it easier for folks to come and give Alaska a try, it certainly helps us attract the professionals we need. In terms of the workload for the division, joining the compacts will reduce in many cases the workload that the division sees, because again, the people are applying through the compact, the PA one that we just spoke about most recently. You know, you apply through the compact for a compact privilege in the other states, and so it lessens the workload on the division.
Okay, good to know. All right, thank you.
Thank you. And I, for the committee's awareness, I just want to remind everybody that we're still in the sectional analysis, technically, and we still have Ms. Hall available to help answer questions specific to the PA compacting. And so if we could hold off more general questions having to do with RHCP or compacting in general, if we could just wait until the end after we get through the sectional, I would appreciate it. Thank you very much, Director Robb. And I believe Representative Fields had a comment to make specific to Representative Sadler's question a couple of minutes ago.
Through the chair, Zach Fields. The way that CMS scores these things, there's not transparency around the amount of points we do or don't get based on the number of compacts we do or don't pass, and the requirement to get whatever points, but they don't say how many points, is by 2028. So, again, my view is if the stakeholders support them, there's no reason not to do them. The timeline is not the end of this session, and it's also not clear how much, if at all, we would be penalized. So, again, I support the commissioner writing them in there. I think it was strategic, and appreciate the opportunity to vet them out with stakeholders.
Okay, additional questions for Ms. Hall? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your time, Ms. Hall. We appreciate your time and expertise, and I'll turn it back over to Ms. Owen.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff to Rep Fields. I will go through sections 5 through 10, which establish the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, or the SIPACT. The SIPACT covers two specific practice scenarios, telepsychology and temporary in-person services. A licensed psychologist in a SIPACT state may provide telepsychology services to clients in any other SIPACT state and may also travel to another SIPACT state to provide in-person psychological services for up to 30 days per year without needing a separate license in that state. To participate, a psychologist must hold an active e-passport for telepsychology or an interjurisdictional practice certificate for temporary in-person practice. the state where a client is located governs the applicable scope of practice, and home states retain authority over their own licensees. Any adverse action in a SIPAC state immediately revokes both the e-passport and the IPC, removing compact privileges in all member states. This bill also adds a fingerprint-based background check requirement for psychologist licensure consistent with the SIPAC standards.
Could we, for reference, I hate to interrupt, but there's it's a long sectional and a long bill. Could you maybe reference which page of the bill we're speaking of? Because there's a number of places where there's multiple sections. That'd be very kind of you. Because the sectional speaks of section, you know, 5 through da-da-da, and it goes to a new article, then goes to a new section. So just for clarity of record, please.
Apologies.
Thank you very much, Ms. Owen. Take your time. And if you want, we can take an Addies. We'll take an Addies. We are back on ready. Ms. Owen, if you'd please continue with the sectional.
Okay. For the record, Courtney Owen, staff director at Fields. I think I completed sections 5 through 10 of the narrative. And then section 11 authorizes the Department of Public Safety to conduct national criminal history record checks in connection with licensure under all four compacts. For online for invited testimony, we have Marvo Reginden, Executive Director of the Alaska Psychological Association, as well as Dr. Kevin Tarlow, who is the Board Secretary of the Alaska Psychological Association. I think they will be doing a joint presentation. Actually, can we take a quick brief at ease?
At ease. Yeah. All right, we are back on record. Thank you, everybody, for your patience. We're going to turn it over to invited testimony regarding the Psychology Interstate Compact, beginning with Marvo Reginden, Executive Director of the Alaska Psychological Association. I apologize if I butchered your name, but please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. And for the record, my name is Marvo Reginden. I am the Executive Director for Alaska Psychological Association, and on behalf of the board, I want to thank you to the committee and Representatives Fields and Hall for inviting us to present on SIPAC. As was said, I also have our board secretary, Dr. Tarlow, with me, who is a licensed psychologist as well as an instructor at a professor at University of Alaska, and he would be able to provide answers to more technical questions. And I do appreciate you also putting up my slides. So just a little bit about APPA, Alaska Psychological Association. We are connected with the American Psychological Association. We do have a working relationship with our state licensing board, whose mission is to protect the public, whereas our mission or our purpose is to provide continuing education and advocacy that helps members advance their careers and become successful in their clinical practice. Next slide, please. According to the Department of Commerce, there are 325 psychologists with an active license in Alaska, and our members are located in the larger cities and municipalities, as you might expect. Despite our name being the Psychological Association, we have 150 members that also include, besides licensed psychologists, licensed psychological associates, which is a master's level, licensed professional counselors, licensed social workers, some non-clinical affiliates, and students as well. Next slide, please. So SIPAC, which is this Psychological Interjurisdictional Compact, is something that the board has been aware of for a number of years. It has been on our legislative agenda for the past 2 years. Our past boards have been supportive of SIPAC overall, but has not made a statement of endorsement because it's never been a piece of conversation. But this year, as of our January meeting, board meeting, the current board began some deep discussions on the pros and cons of SIPAC. And before they wanted to make a determination and a statement, they have decided that they would want to poll the membership to find out their take on SIPAC. So we have started a poll, and we will present some of that information to you today. Alaska is one of three states with SIPAC legislation that is being introduced this year. And there are currently 41 states in the compact, with 39 being fully active. Slide, please. We know that SIPAC is not perfect. It's not a perfect piece for us. There are some limitations that have raised a lot of concerns. One is that graduates, those who can participate must have graduated from an APA accredited program. And with two universities that have a doctoral program, in psychology, only one is APA accredited, and that being University of Alaska. Alaska Pacific University is not currently accredited. From my understanding, they don't currently have the required number of full-time professors to maintain 1,000 hours of residency. And I'm sure there are other aspects as well. SIPAC also does not apply to a licensed psychological associate, which is that master's level that I spoke of. And I believe that's because that the American Psychological Association has not yet established an accredited master's program in psychology, and yet there are 17 to 23 states that does recognize that master's level, and Alaska is one of them. Next slide, please. As I said, the board decided it before they wanted to make any sort of a statement, they wanted to poll the membership. And the survey went out on Friday. So we are 5 days into this survey at this point, and we intend to survey all the way through the end of March. So we'd be happy to provide updated information or results on that survey. So let's get into that survey, if you don't mind. So as you can see, at this point, 82% indicate that they have a current active license as a psychologist in Alaska, and 82% also say that they currently provide services to patients located in Alaska. Next page. 64% say that their doctoral degree was APA accredited at the time of graduation. And starting in question number four is when these responses now start, do you see a lot of divisions starting to happen? So do you support Alaska adopting SIPAC? At this point, 50% are strongly supportive, with 9% that are neutral or somewhat supportive. If you take those three categories, that's 64%. Somewhat opposed to strongly opposed, that equals about 32%. Next slide, please. If Alaska joins SIPAC, what effect would it have on your practice? And as you can see in the middle, 36% that say that there would be no significant effect, yet 27% say there would be a major positive effect. that's somewhat telling me that those who have participated may not know enough about SAGPAC to know what would happen, you know, how it's going to affect their practice. And Dr. Tarlow may also have some thoughts on that as well. Number six, asking how likely would they participate in SAGPAC, and it's nice to see that 41% said that they would more than likely, or very likely to practice, with somewhat likely and unsure rounding that up to about 23%, an additional 23%. As you see at the bottom too, 23% also indicate that they are not eligible. Next slide, please. Which potential benefit is most important? And as you can see, that second line of 45% is continued care for relocating patients. So again, being able to cross state lines to help those who are crossing state lines to continue the therapy with them. And then our last question is, what concerns is most important to you? And as you can see towards the bottom at 23%, exclusion of non-APA or CPA graduates is the most concern that they have. With others of reduced oversight from out-of-state competition and oversight, enforcement of Alaska laws and standards or impact on local practices, also rounding out that list. Go to the next slide, please. Some of the comments that we've had already are, you know, in favor. We are seeing that people that have lived in another state that also have SAGPAC feel that it's helpful for patients who are traveling and need continuity of care when working with people who moved out of state, especially college students who are away for parts of the year. Others say that there have been positive and negatives of SAGPAC, but overall they feel it's beneficial for both patients and providers. They do indicate that there is a need to understand the different laws and regulations when they cross state lines. And a third is also saying the primary benefit would be continuity of care, not just for patients who permanently locate to the lower 48, including military families, but also for patients who spend large amounts of the year in Alaska and also substantial amounts of the year elsewhere, such as snowbirds, those in the oil industry and others. Comments that are opposed to it, the licensing board, whose, again, their mission is to protect the public, say that the Alaska Board of Psychologists would not be able to enforce various laws and provisions that may be required for Alaskans. The state of Alaska would bear costs for licensure complaints without remuneration. That's a tough word for me today. And then also APU would never be able to qualify for APA accreditation if it does. Next slide, please. So for our next steps, the board has a board meeting next week, next Wednesday, and they will take a look at what survey results are looking like at that time, and then make a determination, do we have enough surveys in from our membership to be able to decide on making a statement, or do we need to continue on so that we have enough survey respondents to be able to do something. So we have until the end of March, unless they decide they want to do it before the end of March. I have been in contact with Dr. Orwick, who is the executive director of SAGPAC, and she is very willing to participate in the town hall meeting, should we decide to do one, to help educate Alaska psychologists on the compact, and we would record that for those who are not able to attend. So with that, I would like to entertain any questions, and like I said, we do have Dr. Tarlow here, who can answer some specific questions related to the field of psychology and how things work, and I do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We have several questions in the queue, beginning with Representative Freer.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Thank you, Mr. Rigudin, for your presentation.
I'm just curious about the survey's only been open for 5 days, and I know it's extended. It's extended through the end of March. I'm curious about the number of participants so far, or as of this data.
As of this data, we've had 22.
Thank you. Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Just in terms of your timing, like I said, I introduced this bill to get stakeholder input. So, I mean, it's really the committee's bill is how our process works, but I would be inclined to think if we don't have direction, it might make sense to strip out this part and advance the parts that do have support. If, on the other hand, you make a decision by March 11th and you support it, we could keep it in this package. So, you know, our legislative session ends in mid-May, but as a practical matter, if we're going to advance this bill from committee and have it have a chance of passing, we might not want to wait until the end of March. So just some time frame things for you all to think about and maybe for other committee members to think about.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Next, we have Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I just want to clarify, maybe with, I'm not sure with, but if somebody does not choose to join the compact, does that prevent them from practicing in Alaska? And I ask that because if these survey results hold true with a larger sample population, then it sounds like there's some reasonable concern about APA or APU graduates who are not APA accredited. And would they still be able to practice in Alaska, just not under a SciPact license? I'm not sure who's the best to answer that question.
I'll ask Dr. Parlow to answer that question, please.
Yes, through the chair. So joining SciPact would not in any way limit the scope of practice for licensees, currently licensed psychologists in the state of Alaska. It would mean that they couldn't seek the credential, the e-passport credential that would allow them to obtain an authorization to practice telepsychology or a temporary authorization to practice in person in other member SciPact states, but it wouldn't impair their ability or limit their ability to serve patients in Alaska in the way that psychologists have always served in Alaska.
Just real quick, thank you, Mr. Tarlow. Could you please state your name and your association for the record? And after that, Representative Carrick has a follow-up question for you.
Yes, for the record, I'm Dr. Kevin Tarlow. I'm a licensed psychologist and secretary of the Board of Directors for the Alaskan Psychological Association.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Carrick?
Just a follow-up through the chair. So if someone is not able to join SciPact, were we to pass this legislation, it's your understanding that they would not have their practice that they're currently doing impeded. They just would not be able to gain the benefits of joining the compact. I'm just trying to restate it again to make sure I understand.
Yes, through the chair, that's correct. It wouldn't change their ability to practice. It would mean they couldn't participate in the extra opportunities that SciPact would open up for psychologists.
Just one more follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the co-chair. And do you anticipate any other detriment to those who would not be able to join SciPact should this legislation pass? Like, is there some component of passing the compact that inherently harms the practice of those who would not be able to join the compact?
Through the chair, right now I can't think of any, but I think that's something that we will continue to listen from our membership, especially for our members that might be ineligible for SciPact to understand if they have concerns. But I can't think of anything specific right now.
Thank you. Representative Colomb?
Through the chair, I think this would be for Mr. Rigundin. I had a question on the comments opposed slide. In the middle, it says the state of Alaska would bear the cost of licensure complaints without remuneration. Oh, is that true? Or can you speak to that at all? Or is that just is that what people that took the survey, their understanding, that we're bearing the cost for the complaints? I thought the compact dealt with complaints, but any clarity on that?
To the chair, that was a comment that was added as a note, and I'm not able to answer exactly how that works or what that means. I'm just pulling a comment that was part of the survey. Dr. Tarlow, do you have any idea?
Yes, so under SIPACT, ultimately complaints against license holders can revert back to the home state where the licensee is, holds their license. It's also, there's a process where it's also possible to file a complaint with the board where where the patient is located. So that might be a patient in Alaska. That said, if like the other compacts we've discussed, if there's ever a disciplinary action against a SIPACT license holder in any state, it would automatically revoke their authorization to practice and hold that e-passport credential. So complaints, wherever they're filed, it would prevent that provider from practicing.
Follow up. So it would prevent them from practicing everywhere, or could they still practice in their home state, or they're just out of the compact?
They would be out of the compact automatically if they have any disciplinary action taken against them in any jurisdiction. And then it would go back to whether or not their license was suspended in their home state. The license to practice would be different than the SIPAC credential that would allow them to practice across jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. And I think to comment on that, I think the general benefits of compact licensure are kind of generally accepted, but the devil is in the details. This bill envisions four different and, mm-hmm. Fairly expensive detailed compacts and how they deal with things, discipline, accreditation, a whole plethora of issues. We can't simply throw up our hands and say compacts are good, so we'll just rubber stamp whatever there is. So I appreciate the chance to ask some details. Also, we're hearing from the Alaska Psychological Association. I'm not sure if they speak for the association. There might be contrary points of view among psychologists in Alaska and institutions as well, so I'd like to know what their thoughts are. And actually, just a real framing question, is SIPACT, which is a great branding, incidentally, is that a creature or creation of the American Psychological Association, or what is SIPACT? Who started it? Who operates it?
Yes, so SIPACT was
Who's created, speaking, please?
This is Dr. Tarlow.
Thank you, Dr. Tarlow.
SIPACT has been around for a number of years. I believe the three organizations that created the model legislation to establish SIPACT were the ASPPB, which is the Association of All of the State and Provincial Psychology Licensing Boards, this American Psychological Association, which is the national accreditor for doctoral programs in professional psychology, and I believe the Trust, which is not the Alaska Mental Health Trust, but the Trust, which is the largest a provider of liability malpractice insurance to psychologists.
And follow up?
Follow up.
Could you please repeat the first organization? It was the ASPBA. I missed that, please.
Yes, it's ASPPB, the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards.
State and Provincial Psychology Boards, okay.
For the record, that was Dr. Kevin Tarlow.
Thank you. And they wrote the model legislation. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you both very much for your time and for your presentation. I will turn we'll turn back over to Ms. Owen for the sectional analysis for the last part of the compact of the bill, which is the Emergency Medical Service Compact.
I believe there's one more invited testifier online.
Oh, excuse me.
Eric Christensen, licensed clinical social worker.
Okay, excuse me. Mr. Christensen, are you here for invited testimony? I'm going to take an Addies.
All right, we're back on record. We are still considering the psychology interstate compact sectional analysis, and we will turn to invited testifier Eric Christensen, who is a licensed clinical social worker. Mr. Christensen, would you please put yourself on the record, identify yourself and your association, and your comments on the compact are welcome. And Mr. Christensen, if you are online and can hear me, you are on mute. Okay, we will put a pause on that, and we will continue on to the sectional analysis regarding emergency medical service compact. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Ms. Owen to run through the sectional, and then we will have two folks online for invited testimony.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff to Rep Fields. So sections 12 and 13 establish the recognition of the EMS Personal Licensure Interstate Compact, or REPLICA. REPLICA allows licensed EMS personnel, so EMTs, advanced EMTs, and paramedics, to cross state lines and immediately provide care under a recognized privilege to practice without a separate license in each state they enter. Eligibility requires an unrestricted home state EMS license at or above the EMT level and operation under the supervision of a licensed medical director. A provider's scope of practice in a remote state defaults to their home state scope unless restricted by that state. REPLICA also includes provisions to expedite licensure for veterans and military spouses. Disciplinary actions in any member state automatically affect a provider's compact privileges across all states, and a centralized database tracks licensure and adverse action information. Online, we have Brian Webb, firefighter 2 paramedic. He is with the Department of Health, as well as Dr. Mike Levy, chief medical officer for the Anchorage area-wide EMS.
Great. With that, we'll turn it over to Brian Webb. Mr. Webb, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your invited testimony?
Yes, thank you, and chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Webb, and I represent Alaska Department of Health within the Office of Emergency Medical Services. So thanks for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 352, which would allow Alaska to join the EMS compact and to support the RHTP process. And the primary reason the Department of Health supports the EMS compact is workforce mobility. Alaska periodically faces situations where we must rapidly expand our EMS workforce. Just as an example, in 2007, when Shell Oil began preparing for Arctic offshore drilling, Alaska suddenly needed more than 70 paramedics and additional EMT personnel. Our in-state workforce could not support that demand, and the licensing process for the temporary workforce became extremely burdensome. We see similar challenges every year during wildfire season, when EMS clinicians move rapidly both into and out of Alaska to support our response operations. And each year, our EMS licensing office must divert significant time and resources processing temporary licenses for these EMS clinicians. The compact would reduce that regulatory burden by allowing vetted EMS clinicians from other member states to practice here through a verified privilege to practice rather than requiring full Alaska licensure. The second major benefit is public safety. The compact provides access to a national coordinated database that gives states real-time notification of disciplinary actions and, importantly, investigations ongoing in other states. This helps prevent what's called state shopping, where a clinician under investigation attempts to obtain licensure in another state before disciplinary actions occur. That system is going to strengthen Alaska's ability to protect the public. It's also important to clarify what the EMS compact does not do. The receiving state always maintains absolute control, and any EMS clinician practicing in Alaska under the compact must affiliate with an Alaska-authorized EMS agency, follow that agency's protocols and standing orders, and practice under the medical direction of that agency's EMS medical director's approved scope of practice. Put simply, that EMS Compact allows workforce mobility without surrendering Alaska's control. And there's no such thing as a free-range medic under the EMS Compact. And unlike some of the other compacts, the EMS Compact ensures local EMS agencies remain fully in control of whether they accept personnel, management of pay scales, determines longevity, and service-specific background checks, and whether Alaska licensure is ultimately required. Participation is optional for Alaska EMS clinicians, not mandatory. Any concerns for impacts to our rural EMS clinicians are just unfounded. And existing Alaska EMS clinicians are grandfathered into the compact without additional requirements. So in closing, the EMS compact reduces regulatory burdens. It supports Alaska workforce needs during disasters and major projects, and it strengthens public protection. The Department of Health believes joining the EMS compact is a real positive step forward for our EMS systems and the communities we serve. So thank you for the opportunity. I'll be happy to answer any questions or provide clarifications.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Does any committee member have a question for Mr. Webb? Representative Sadler?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Webb. I have seldom heard a representative of an executive department give unqualified support for any bill. It's always the department has no opinion. Just this is surprising. Please, why are you giving us such unqualified support for something?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Brian Webb again. I may have stepped out of line in regards to my testimony. The Department of Health isn't directly supporting this, but we are part of it. So if I stepped out of line, I'll apologize for that.
No apology. I'm gratified to hear some clear support for a bill, but just want to give you the opportunity to clarify. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for testifying, Mr. Webb. One of the major concerns with the nurse license compact is the ability to rapidly expand the workforce in potential circumstances of strike or union negotiations. Do EMS workers currently have a union that represents some or all of the profession in Alaska?
There are several, through the chair, Representative Carrick, Brian Webb. Yes, there are several unions that represent EMS and fire workforce, the International Association of Firefighters, and also the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association. Those are the two main groups that represent or push legislation supportive of workforce for the union members.
Follow up.
Just a comment, Madam Co-Chair. I generally am supportive of compacts, but I do think it would be valuable to hear from those union organizations on their thoughts regarding the EMS compact as well, just to add that perspective to the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Co-Chair Fields.
Through the chair, we will reach out to them. Thank you. And I'm happy to reach out to any other stakeholders who we may have missed so far.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Fields.
Just a comment.
Representative Cole.
So just a comment about that. So I think it is important for the unions to have a voice, but my understanding of the compacts is to increase access to care, to take care of people. So I'm hoping if there are issues with the unions, we can work that out so we have more access to care, we have more access to services.
Thank you, Representative Cole. Additional comments or questions from the committee for Mr. Webb? Not seeing any, we will turn now to, thank you very much, Mr. Webb. We will now turn to Dr. Mike Levy with Anchorage Area-Wide EMS, the Chief Medical Officer up there. Dr. Levy, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Field and Hall. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Michael Levy. I testify on behalf of myself. I'm an EMS physician. I'm the medical director for emergency programs for the state of Alaska. I'm the chief medical officer for Anchorage Area-Wide EMS, the medical director for Anchorage Fire, EMS medical director for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I'm a past president of the National Association of EMS Physicians. I've had over 30 years of experience in EMS in Alaska and nationally. I'm here to respectfully urge you to support this bill for adopting recognition of EMS personnel licensure interstate compact, known as REPLICA. We know it as EMS Compact. This legislation helps us get qualified EMS clinicians to patients faster, improves public safety, and can do so at essentially no cost to the state. EMS Compact is a state-to-state agreement that lets EMTs or paramedics who is fully licensed in one state to practice in another state and privileged to practice while still being fully regulated by the state EMS offices. As you know, it's been enacted in 25 states, I believe. Reasons to adopt include, first, the Compact directly improves patient access to care. It lets border area ambulance, specialty teams, mutual aids cross state lines and begin care immediately instead of waiting for the process of getting licenses and temporary waivers. This certainly affects us during wildfires, severe storms, earthquakes, other mass casualty, or even large planned events. The Compact would allow rapid deployment of additional EMS clinicians without waiting for formal disaster declarations, for example. Third, it supports in rural and underserved frontier remote areas by giving us access to a much larger national workforce with over 400,000 qualified EMS clinicians across the Core 48 and Compact states without adding any new administrative burden. The Compact actually raises the bar for safety. Member states must meet common standards, including national registry testing for initial EMT and paramedic licensure, as well as being FBI compliant fingerprint-based background checks. State EMS offices retain our full authority. The individual must associate with an agency. They cannot be free roving. The home state controls the individual's license, and any remote state can immediately restrict or revoke practice privilege. And that's coordinated through the National EMS Coordinated Database. In practice, this means more information, faster notification of problems, clearer enforcement tools than we have under traditional one-state-at-a-time licensure. The Compact also modernizes our workforce. It allows EMS clinicians to move, work, and respond across state lines in a way that matches how many people actually live and work today, supporting recruitment, retention, and reduction of burnout. It specifically helps military members and their spouses who often have to relocate quickly but have to keep serving their communities as EMS clinicians without starting their licensing processes from scratch every time they move. In short, the EMS Compact gives us faster access to qualified EMS clinicians for our communities, stronger patient protections, and better information sharing for regulators, modern workforce flexibility, while preserving full state and local control. For these reasons, I respectfully ask you to vote yes on the EMS Compact legislation. Thank you for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Levy. Does Representative Sadler, yes, you have a question.
Absolutely. So, yeah, through the chair, Dr. Levy, I sure would appreciate hearing your comments in writing or just reviewing them at my leisure. But would you believe that your support for this licensure compact is universal among emergency physicians? Are there alternative points of view that you think we might need to hear from? Or does everybody agree with believe what you believe?
Through the chair and to Representative Sadler, and respectfully, I really can't say that I can speak for all EMS physicians. All things that we engage upon, at least as physicians, seem to have controversy. I do think that my general impression is that there is significant support for it. I think there's significant support for it in the state, but I can't say that it's 100%, nor can I give you a percentage.
Follow up.
We heard from the psychologist that they are polling their members. Have you experienced any polling among your colleagues in the emergency medical field about this issue on compacts?
We have not.
You have not. Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions from the committee? Co-chair Fields.
If it works for committee members, maybe we can see what the psychologists say on March 11th and then maybe collectively make a decision about what we do with the bill. I might throw that out there as an idea on timeline.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. Regarding Dr. Levy's testimony, do committee members have any additional comments or questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Levy. We appreciate it. We also appreciate your time as well, Mr. Webb. With that, Ms. Owen, that I believe concludes the sectional. At this point, I'd like to open up the committee for additional questions or comments. We have a number of subject matter experts available, including Sylvan Robb, The division director for the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. We have Lori Winghire in the room, the legislative healthcare liaison. We have Carl Sims, the program director for the National Center for Interstate Compacts, available online. And we also have Donnie Woodyard, the executive director at the Interstate Commission for EMS Personnel Practice. So with that, I'd like to open it up to the committee, and beginning with Representative Klum.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I was wondering if Lori Winghire could come to the table for some questions.
Thank you for joining us, Ms. Winghire. Please put yourself on the record, and here we go.
For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the healthcare liaison for the state legislature.
Okay, so through the chair, thank you for being here. So many questions, but I have two that maybe we could start it out.
Sure.
One, if you see when you see compacts come through, and what's your knowledge of? How does this affect reimbursement rates? Does it affect reimbursement rates? And also, does it, I guess I'm kind of questioning how insurance bills these people, like in-network and out-of-network. If you're flying around the country, how does that interact with insurance?
Through the chair to Representative Klum, the compacts themselves will not impact reimbursement at all.
Okay.
A separate issue. I mean, they may see their costs go down some because of the compact, but not enough to impact reimbursement rates.
Okay. Across the board.
Across the board.
Okay. Representative Klum, I believe you had another question, but I see that you're writing too.
Sorry.
Yep.
What was my other question? There's this issue of with the union and the striking and the compacts and how they affect the personnel that already work here. Do you know or have you seen that that has been a major problem in other states? Is this something we really need to be concerned about, if you know?
Through the chair, that I don't really have any knowledge of. I know Rep. Fields has some, but how the unions view these, I know they've gone back and forth between the union, yet some of the members individually support. I don't know enough to answer your question.
Could I have one more question?
Just real quick, I believe Co-Chair Fields has a comment on that.
Through the chair, I did introduce a separate bill on the NLC, trying to see if we could find a compromise to get a middle ground among stakeholders, and we can discuss that in detail. I'm in the process right now of talking to stakeholders about it, so
okay.
I'm exploring that.
Okay. I did have one other, if
yes,
I'm allowed
Representative
to.
Klum.
Overall, do you think, like, I know there's a lot of things that we do here that can increase health costs and insurance rates. Does this affect the cost of health care or the premiums on insurance?
Through the chair to Representative Klum, I don't think it will. What I do think it will do is increase access to health care, and so that you would be able to get into a provider sooner. But I don't think it's going to impact or have any significant impact that any of us will notice on what we're paying for insurance or what we're paying for health care.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Great. Additional questions from the committee? Representative Carrick.
Yes, to the co-chair. I've first just had a comment. If there are compacts within this legislation that we're not comfortable with by the conclusion of the committee process, I've also thought that a potential sunset date on one or multiple components is a potential medium ground where we don't know what the full impact is. But I did have a question for Sylvan Robb, I think. Sorry to kick the swing higher out of the hot seat. So through the chair to Ms. Robb, I noticed that there's zero fiscal notes for CBPL, and there's a couple of professional additions here potentially for fingerprinting and background checks, but we have in both fiscal notes a note that this is going to help streamline licensing. So why aren't we seeing a fiscal note that shows a cost savings?
For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, that's a great question. Part of it is that we don't have a crystal ball, and so it's hard to predict what we might see in terms of how many individuals who currently hold an Alaska license may be able in the future to work through the compact and not need to get that Alaska license because they'll be working through their respective compact. Additionally, we're expecting to see some efficiencies, but there are places where we can redirect staff to improve processing time on other programs, so we don't really anticipate, while we see efficiencies, not necessarily savings to the state in the immediate term.
Okay, great. Additional questions from the committee in general about the bill, Representative Sadler?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is the first introduction of the bill, and we have heard from invited testifiers. It's a 97-page bill. The sectional analysis is one page. The sectional narrative is 16 pages. It includes reference to a lot of compacts that have details and procedures that are idiosyncratic. They're not universal. I guess I want to say that if we are to give this bill the attention it deserves, we're going to need some time. Given the stakes for the rural health transformation money, the impacts on some very important professions, the economy, public health, I would ask for a couple of weeks to work on this at least. I would really appreciate that we give this the attention and time it deserves. I appreciate the audacity of the sponsor for putting four big compacts into one bill, but respectfully, we've got to take some time on this.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Sadler. Co-Chair Fields has a
through the chair, Representative Sadler. This is like the Super Bowl of compacts, and the Super Bowl does take longer than other football games. So, yes, I fully appreciate that and want to do all the stakeholder outreach and make sure we're doing the right thing. And I do think it'll take at minimum 2 weeks because I want to hear back from the psychologist.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. Be crazy not to.
Representative Sadler, take that pun in intent.
Oh, my God.
I'll keep it light a little bit.
Additional comments or questions from the committee? All right, not seeing any at this time. Thank you, everybody who participated in the invited testimony for this important bill. Thank you to the committee committee members for your patience and for your comments and questions. We will definitely be having this bill in front of us multiple times in the future. With that, this concludes our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet next on Friday, March 6th at 3:15 p.m., where we will hear HJR 38 regarding urging Congress to pass the Enhancing First Response Act. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 5:05 p.m.